car enthusiasts and the people who love them.
Hello, thank you for joining us. This is The Thing About Cars, coming to you from Strongbox West in Atlanta. As usual, around the table we have...
Becca.
Andrew.
I'm Mickey and...
Ben.
Ben, give us a quick Lotus update.
Well, the long-awaited dashboard reinstall has basically happened. There's a few loose ends to tie up, but it is in the car. It's got some screws holding it in. The wiring is connected, and the circuits all work.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. There was a resistor you were having issues with in there?
Well, the one that really held up the whole works was the heater fan, or the motor for the fan. Yeah, the heater goes in before the dashboard, and the fan is between the heater and the bulkhead of the car. Mm-hmm. So I get the heater put back in. I had reconditioned the fan motor myself. It worked on the bench, put it in the car, it doesn't work.
Right.
So, okay, long process trying to find another one. This is not a commonly used motor in any British car, basically. Mm-hmm. I had some part numbers to go on. Through some referrals and phone calls, I found a motor in California that looked right and should fit. So I get it installed, and it doesn't fit. And there was not enough clearance for the heater to... go all the way into its spot, which is going to cause problems with the dashboard because some of the dashboard components come within millimeters of the heater. So I had to, go through some more process. I eventually found a brand new motor that physically fit size-wise, but I had to improvise the mountings for it.
Interesting.
But electrically, it was superior because with the original circuit, there's an external resistor that provides you with the low speed on the fan. This motor had the high and low speed built into it, so I could just completely bypass the resistor and go straight to the switch.
Yep.
So that got done. Then I had, just various and sundry other issues with making this all fit, because you take a dashboard out, you take it completely apart, you refinish it, refurbish it, redo everything, and put it back together. And before it came out, it had been in there for almost 50 years.
Sure.
Everything kind of settling and taking a certain fit. So once you've disturbed all that, it's not going to go back in as easily.
Right.
And then, of course, I've changed the electrical circuits a little bit. What I did was I eliminated about 30-odd individual wire bullet connectors, which the British loved in those days for some cockamamie reason, and replaced them with a couple of big, 15-pin Molex plugs. There's a lot of troubleshooting you have to do when you do those kind of electrical modifications. As straight as you may think you've done it, once you plug it in, something's not going to be right.
So what comes next?
Now it's the suspension. Mm-hmm. I've had the front back together and hadn't started yet on the rear when I realized that the ride height on the car had been completely wrong. So I've got a set of completely ride height adjustable brand new shocks and springs and everything from a nice UK supplier. When you find a big 80-pound box with a foreign return address on your doorstep, it's like, yay.
It's Christmas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The rear suspension required a little bit of welding and modification to make the adjustable spring perches attach. And so I've got a little bit of a technical issue going on with that. The spring perch welding was fine, but now I've got the guy who did the welding discovered that one of the wheel bearings is bad.
Oh.
So I'm kind of wrestling with getting that out. It doesn't want to come out.
Sure.
But once that's all back in, suspension will be back together and,
then it'll be at the right ride height and you'll be happy.
Yeah, there's really not that much to do once all that's done. I've got to put the front and rear glass back in and basically put the interior back together with a new set of carpet that has not taken a fit, so I'll have to fight with that a little bit to make it all settle in place.
So wait, but, is it running?
Well, no, because I haven't had anything attached to electrically make it run.
Right.
I do know that my starter needs a little work. When I was testing the dash circuits, I hit the ignition switch and the starter motor is spinning, but the linkage isn't engaging, so I have to yank it out and figure out why.
You've reminded me of something that's going on with my Mazda, and that every once in a while I'll park it and I'll go back to start it up after the engine cools off, and it won't do anything. Dashboard lights up properly. There's plenty of juice getting inside the engine. Then it'll go click, and nothing happens.
You've brought that up before.
So get this. I've discovered that if I rock the car back and forth and then hit it again, it starts right up.
To me, that sounds like a bad starter.
Bingo.
Right off the bat.
It does, yeah.
And it only happens every once in a while.
Well, sorry,
I had a similar issue with my old Super Beetle back in high school.
Mm-hmm.
I had to jump on the rear bumper to make it want to engage.
So, like I said, there's a number of things that lead into this next topic. In fact, let's just go into this next topic. This is a totally relevant. This is something I read off Reddit and I wrote to the poster and got permission to share this here. Her name is Lipbite. And she wrote in a I think this was in Personal Finance, or anyway, what she wrote was, I'm currently mourning the loss of the engine of my baby, which is a 240Z, when my boyfriend came up with this little gem. He says, barring complete annihilation due to scrapyard crusher or some other similar sad fate, all cars are fixable, period. Sure, you may not have the money to do so now, or maybe ever, but that's another issue. But someone else might be able to. Even with the dead engine, our cars still have life in them. They hold memories and moments, maybe a stain or two and a weird smell, like cigars. They have their quirks and their glory days. They all have history. And yes, sometimes it's better to let go and stop dumping money into your mom's old station wagon that's past 220,000 miles. Sometimes we weigh the costs and time against a car's value, and they aren't close to breaking even. From my perspective, that's okay, too. She says, it had a good run, you loved on its good days, hated on it a bit on some other days, and you're both ready to let go. The point is, we're all here because we love our cars. They define us, they bring us joy, give us something to keep our hands busy. We don't give up on them easily, even though that might be the best option. So despite the costs, I'm not giving up on mine. She's far from dead, and I'm not broke yet. So it sounds like she's going to drop a new engine in this thing.
Yeah.
But with my growing laundry list of things that need fixing in the Mazda, I think I agree with her. You know, cars don't die. You simply fall out of love with them, right?
Well, there have been some cars that really you just shouldn't fix. They might be fixable, but you just shouldn't. So yeah. Especially after a big hurricane like, what was that last one, Irma, that came up here through Georgia, and everything was sitting underwater, and there were so many cars that customers brought afterwards. Is this fixable? Well, yes, but in reality, you shouldn't.
Rip out everything electrical.
Well, I mean, some of them are just bad. Like on the time I was working at a shop that specialized in BMW, we'd have them come in the ABS module that's sitting underneath that floor pan by the jack point, it would just be flooded and it's toast. And if you drive through a big puddle, you do the same thing. And it's like that right there is going to total the value of the car, technically. Mm-hmm. And all totaled really means is that the repairs exceed the value of the car.
Right.
So when you think
and
about...
it's even more complicated than that, but yeah.
Right. Well, that's just the simple...
Yeah.
The repairs exceed the value of the car. So when you factor in things like she was talking about, your experiences in the car, well, then your value for the car goes up.
Yes.
So if you're, you know, 240Z to you is worth $1 million, then it's worth fixing
right
at that point for you.
Right. It's like, well, me, it's, and my Mustang. She's not a car. She's a family member. It's like if
right
my kid needed an expensive medical thing,
right,
I wouldn't hesitate. It's the same thing
but
for me.
Unlike human life, it's easier to put something of a numerical price tag on a car.
Sure.
Speak about your car.
Right.
Well, I'm giving him the eye.
As that whole right balance between, you know, is it just a tool for you know, you're making your life easier, or is it something you enjoy?
Right.
You know, if it's that appliance on wheels that just gets the kids to school and the grocery home, you know, then
that's the Jeep.
You know, yeah, it may not be worth it to dump a lot in, but if it's, you know, like an old Lotus or an old Mustang,
right,
and you're in it for specifically for the enjoyment of it, then, yeah, you could put some money in and not have any regret.
And I think that comes back to, I recently had to sell a truck that I was kind of sad to have to let go because I couldn't get parts for it. And because here in Georgia we have an emissions inspection, if you can't get parts that you need to make it pass emissions, you cannot register the vehicle. So I had to sell it out of county. It was a 1996 Nissan truck, and it needed a fuel pump assembly. It was cracked and leaking fuel, and it turned the check engine light on because it wouldn't hold a pressure in the gas tank for the EVAP system.
Oh, okay.
And because of this, they only sell the pump motor. They don't sell the assembly. And I looked and looked and looked and looked and looked, and the truck ran fine. If you used flex tape or something to fix it, you could. Well, then the airbag light came on, and I was just like, here we go.
Yeah.
I need a clock spring now. Doesn't make you fail emissions,
right,
but because the airbag was not going to work without a clock spring, I didn't feel safe with my fiance driving the truck. And
don't let her drive it.
Well, my Chevy truck is what I drive. This one was going to be just for her. And I was like, you know, at this point, I can't get a clock spring. I can't get a fuel pump. It's starting to be hard to find any parts at all for this thing. It's got to go. So I ended up selling the truck. So with that in mind, a 240 has a big aftermarket following. People love the Nissan 240. People love Mustangs. When you're talking about Mustangs, there'll be parts available for this thing, or fixes or bypasses or ways to make it keep going. But when you talk about vehicles, like you mentioned mom's old station wagon in the post, if mom's old station wagon isn't something that there's parts availability for affordable price points, things get hard to fix. I'm sure you're going through this with the Lotus, trying to find these parts. You were just talking about the motor, how much trouble you went through trying to get that to work, to find one.
Yeah, that's actually a bad example because it's actually a very well-supported car, believe it or not.
Well,
but I'm just talking about finding parts, how difficult it can be to find particular parts.
Oh, so I was about to say, easy. I think he has an easier time finding parts for the Lotus than I have for finding for the Pontiac G8.
Yes.
Okay.
Because the G8 is, it's not even that old. It's 10 years old now, and it's nearly impossible.
There are some difficult parts on the Lotus, like a brake master cylinder. I did go through that recently.
Yeah.
But for a lot of other things, just call somebody and give them a credit card number, and it'll be on my doorstep.
The difference being, though, is that there's an involved bunch of people who are in it. They're in it.
Right. But like the Pontiac, that's another example. That company has gone out of business, and I had a customer with a Pontiac Grand Am, one of those two. It needed a PCM. Mm-hmm. And if you get a used one, you have to program it. And who's going to do that anymore for a car company that's been out of business for more than 10 years?
There are some people out there, but you don't want to know what they charge.
Well, this customer was just trying to get by, and they couldn't afford it. And what it ended up doing was taking a PCM from a Buick, and then it passed emissions as a Buick and not as a Pontiac, and it worked out. So.
And now Max is going to start yelling at me. I never remember the names. There's actually just a blank computer out there you can buy, and I don't remember the name brand. He loves it, and you can have just custom top to bottom something flashed on there, which may be an option for some people depending on the price of it.
So who bought your truck, the one that you did not want to sell?
I took it out to Barrow County where they don't have any inspections, and I just put it for sale at a friend's shop, and somebody drove by and said, I have one of these trucks, I'd like another one, and this one looked pretty good, and he bought it.
So I was wondering if it might have been a collector or someone who knew how to fix things.
Yeah, I actually do have another one of these Nissan trucks. I love the D21 body style. I leave them completely stock. I don't put any of the aftermarket nonsense on them. But the other ones I have, the 88, is too old for an emissions inspection. There's nothing wrong with it. There's no airbag clock spring. It doesn't have airbags. And it's easier to keep track of that one. But the 96 had to pass, couldn't, and I had to eventually sell it. I was sad about that.
All right. Well, I've got a trivia question that I want to put on the table as our weekly element of Think About Cars trivia. We still need to name that thing. We need to.
Yeah.
Anyway, so the question is, what tailgate accessory did the first and second generation Honda CR-Vs come equipped with? Was it a picnic table, a beverage cooler, a tailgate grill, or a porta potty? So think about that for a second, and I want to read another post that I got permission to use from a Reddit guy named Cravati. I don't know his real name, of course, but this one's kind of long, so I'm going to try to paraphrase it. He says there are four basic reasons people come in to purchase a car, and he lists the reasons, and then he actually does a good job of saying why you shouldn't buy a car for that specific reason. So number one, he says there people come in to buy a car. Number one, because their current car is messy.
Messy? Define messy.
He says, I've sold a ton of cars to people, and he's a car salesman out in Utah.
New or used?
New.
New cars, okay.
He says, I sold a ton of, maybe used cars. It could be used cars. I sold a ton of cars to people whose current car they hated simply because it was dirty. Some elbow grease or paying for a good detail would have saved them $20,000. he says, the second major reason that people buy new cars.
They should never have kids either.
I agree.
Yeah.
He says the second new reason why people will buy new cars is that they simply want a new technology.
You know why I argue against that? You can install so much more than even is available brand new now. You can customize, and I just find that to be a flimsy reason. I understand so many people want that.
Well, I'm going to kind of point out the other side, though. I understand that wanting to keep an old car with new technology. I understand that point. But from the perspective of the average consumer, they don't know how to do all that stuff. And they also know that once you go get electrical work done on your car, you might get a gremlin and you might have to put up with all this nonsense and how much it's going to cost. They're like, you know what? Just trading this in and getting a down payment on something else is so much easier for financing than anything else. It just makes more sense to get a new one. So in that aspect, I get the general public doing it. But people who know cars, like yourself with your Mustangs, I get that too.
He says, I've sold $50,000 cars weekly because of Bluetooth capabilities. He says, no matter how old your car is, you can add this to any existing car for around $200, cheaper if you can do it DIY.
Right. Yeah.
And actually, I don't even know if I've mentioned it yet, that the Jeep has a new stereo, I guess. I didn't replace the speakers or anything. They seem to be okay. Now I think they might be a little bit lagging with what was new. I wasn't looking for anything crazy.
Right.
But Fry's was having a sale, so all I had to do was get
one
model year old kind of thing on the radio. I got a double din Boss head unit for $70.
Yeah.
Well, that's the thing. It surprises me, but it doesn't surprise me that people are actually trading in an entire car just for Bluetooth.
My friend tried to do that. And it was right after I bought the radio. And it was stupid. I'm going from a single DIN CD radio, and now I've got Bluetooth right. and auxiliary and video. And it boggles my brain that people are buying brand new cars just for that.
Well, and how many that we don't know, how many of them are, you know, maybe in the back of their mind toying with a new car anyway, and that just kind of pushed them over the edge.
They got the excuse they needed. Yeah. Yep, there you go.
So reason number three is that they wanted the new car as a status symbol.
Oh, a lot at BMW. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
He says cars always look amazing in a dealership when they're waxed clean and smothered in Armor All and tire shine. In 2 weeks, the difference between your old car and your new car will probably be negligible. The whole status symbol thing really only lasts a few weeks. Most of your peers don't know the difference between a new and a much older models if they're both dirty. So, again, it goes back to clean your car.
I just thought of something here in Georgia. Maybe we ought to realistically have all the cars in the showroom covered in Georgia red clay.
Yeah.
and pollen.
Dirt road dust, some pollen. You know, we had to just... God. This is what your car is generally going to look like here.
Right. Like, let's do that. We should do like a photo essay or something like that. Here's a 2009 something really, 2019 something super exotic covered in dust and pollen.
And then Georgia red clay in the mud wells, in the fender wells.
For people outside this region who don't know what we're talking about, you know, this red clay is, you know, this is like JB Weld once it sets up. And the pollen is so bad that I have seen my black Mazda turn a nasty shade of green when it's covered with the pollen. Yeah.
Well, the clay is caused by the sap from the pine trees. So if you think about that mixing, it's disgusting. But I still think we need to have a line of car colors that's called Georgia Red Clay or Gravel Road Gray or Pollen Yellow. We just have Georgia-specific colors that it blends.
So, Becca, let's do a vinyl wrap that's an actual picture of gravel, actual sized on your car.
Well, if you do that on a Jeep, people will buy it.
And regional specific marketing is, you know, definitely a seller. I mean, you know, I've seen like Ford pickups have done a lot of this. You go around the country, you'll see versions that you don't have back at home.
Right.
I've seen a New Mexico one. I've seen a Texas one. You know.
Well, Ford is really big on doing area specials, like the high country editions. And
right. So the last reason he says that people will actually come in to purchase a car is mechanical problems. He says, this is the only reason I would advise anyone to purchase a car, especially if the repairs to get to the point where it's more expensive to keep it than to move on. If you are buying a new car for any other reason than this, don't do it. That's what he says. I agree with him. I agree with him on this one particular point. Like, if you have cars, and if that's the point you've gotten to, but again, you have to factor in the whole sentimental part of the equation that we were talking about a minute ago.
Right.
Well, also, I can add a fifth reason is you've got a couple of, you know, two-door Mustangs, and now you have a family, and you need to upgrade to the Explorer or Expedition or Tahoe or whatever you need to do.
Still keep one of the Mustangs.
Of course you can, and I'm not saying to get rid of it, but he's saying the reasons people buy new cars. Not necessarily the reason they would get rid of an old one.
Well, and then there's that Mustang-branded SUV that's rumored to be coming out.
Oh, jeez. Like, what was Lamborghini coming out with the new Urus or whatever they call it, their SUV that they were talking about?
That sounds too much like Yaris.
No, Urus. It starts with a U.
To
me, I just can't get the luxury SUV. It's a sport utility vehicle, and you're going to make it luxury.
And they're never going to take it off the road. No, it came up with the boys the other day. I don't remember why they started it, but if I were to have an accident in the Mustang, and I told them, I don't care how many pieces she's in or how many tow trucks it takes to get her home, she's coming home.
Yes.
She's not going anywhere as long as I'm alive. Right. And they just kind of went, okay.
I knew a guy who had a beat-up Geo Prism, a white one, no less. This was a little GM version of a Corolla once.
Right.
He had about 300,000 miles on it. It was a real beater. And he swore up and down that one of these days he was going to do a nut and bolt restoration on it. Mm-hmm. I said, why?
Because he loves it.
He does.
It's
he did.
The love of the car.
He said it had been with him through thick and thin and everything.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't blame him at all.
I told him good luck getting some of the parts when he comes around to that. But if that's your thing, go for it.
Well, with the Geo, some of the Geos were actually Corollas in disguise.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And with that, the parts availability is there.
Well, yeah, for the hard stuff, but things like inside door handles and things are going to be, you know, tough someday.
Maybe.
Back when I was messing around with Preludes, we were also making a list of other manufacturers' parts that would just happen to fit a Prelude.
Oh, right.
Well, see, that's so, what I need is to find someone who's done that for the Pontiac.
Right. I mean, someone's got to know. I mean, there was an actual list that had been developing in one of those forums once upon a time where people figured out that Eclipse fuel injectors would actually work really well on a I can't remember which Prelude engine it was, but
that interchangeable parts knowledge, that really should be a thing, because suspension springs for lift kits on Jeeps and trucks and things, if they would say, this is how long this spring is, this is how long this spring is, and this is how wide it is, and give the dimensions, to have that kind of database, if there is one, I don't know of it, but that would help out so much. I had a customer with an Isuzu that had broken a spring, and it was a 90s Isuzu, and I couldn't find any in the junkyard, just still had theirs, and I was like, what is up with this? And it turns out I could fit a Chevy Blazer spring. And because of that, that's what I did for them. They were able to go about their way, but that knowledge, without having to walk through pull apart for 7 hours trying to figure it out, would have been super helpful.
Well, you're understating it, though. I mean, you're almost relaxed about it. I don't even know what word I would use to say how amazing, valuable.
It would be super helpful, especially for people who need their cars to just work, which I run across a lot of. Right. They just need to get to work. They just need this.
The question with doing any of that technological work, I think, is how do you get the money to pay for it? Because getting the data from every individual car company is probably not too hard to do. Getting them all to talk to each other is going to take some time and research. Right?
Well, I don't think that's even necessary, because the people who are looking for those parts are looking at older cars. It might just be a matter of somebody out there in the internet world going to the junkyard and spending, this is how long this is. Does this fit on this car? Does this fit?
Well, aspect of doing it for everyday cars is kind of the irony, because in enthusiast circles, these things exist.
They do, but for everyday cars, I mean, I haven't seen an enthusiast circle for the old Isuzus yet.
Exactly, yeah.
All right, real quick, Becca. Tell us about the autopilot. What was that? Tesla autopilot possessed?
I was trying to make it short and sweet. Tesla's autopilot possessed. We've talked a lot about the autonomous technology, pros and cons and everything, and I came across this article. It's just from maybe about a week and a half ago. Tesla driver claims autopilot caused car to drive off the road. and just to kind of read the top part, a Tesla driver claims the autopilot feature on his car took over seconds before he veered off a New Jersey road, and he blamed the vehicle's technology for the crash. So what he is stating in this is that he did not have the autopilot feature on, but apparently it was still active, that it's reading its surroundings and taking in information.
Welcome to Skynet.
Right?
We're here to kill you slowly.
So he's saying he's driving his Tesla Model X when it suddenly veered to the right. The steering wheel locked into place and a message appeared that a new lane was detected. So the car then suddenly veered off to the right. He hit a curb, struck traffic signs, plural, and then drove over another curve before it stopped in a grassy area. So basically he's saying, the autopilot wasn't even on. It just went, oh, hey, there's a new lane, and decided to drive for him and then locked him out.
It locked him out?
Yeah, it wouldn't let him turn the wheel.
Yeah, that's what it was saying up here. Where did that go? The steering wheel locked into place, and then it gave him a message. The automaker's coming back basically saying, that sounds kind of weird, and it doesn't matter. Your hand should be on the wheel, which if your steering wheel is locked, what does it matter where your hands are?
Right.
So I don't know until we see a bunch of stories like this cropping up, if it's just a one-off.
The other thing is, you know, I don't want to discredit anyone for this stuff, but the other thing is, so many people out there say things, and then the actual evidence, in the heat of the moment of them wrecking, they say things happen, but then when you actually get like a dash cam footage, it doesn't line up with what they said. I've seen that in a couple of wrecks where they're like, this happened, it didn't actually happen, or it happened differently. So because of this, I wonder, since we haven't seen very many of these yet, is that really what happened? But then when I think about the Kia Rondo had a problem where it would actually, you would be turning the wheel, but your wheels wouldn't move, their power steering system, and it was causing people to change lanes and have that issue. It could just be a problem with their steering system.
Or, sorry, Ben, you want to say something?
Oh, yeah. Well, I was going to say, too, the thing with the autopilot he may not have thought it was engaged, but there might have been something running in the background. And I wouldn't have thought of this until I saw an example of that with my own car. I've got a now 6-year-old Mazda with a built-in, you know, navigation system, touchscreen radio, you know, that can show you a map and all that. I learned one day that the nav system runs in the background all the time, even if I haven't selected that screen. And
interesting.
Yeah, the way I learned that was I'm driving around one day and I hear this beep or this electronic tone coming from it. I'm going, what the hell is that? And after it did it a couple times, I recognized that sound. That was the sound that the nav system makes when it comes to an area where its database tells it there's a red light camera. Mm-hmm. And then eventually, when I visited an area where I knew this would happen, I turned the screen on. I didn't have any route selected or anything, and sure enough, that's what it was.
Interesting.
Well, yeah. It's got to, I guess, constantly update your GPS for when you do press its button.
Well, it doesn't auto-update it. I actually have to take a SIM card out of the car and plug it into a laptop to update it. But the system runs in the background all the time, apparently.
Well, the only other thing that crosses my mind, and there are plenty of videos out on YouTube, and there have actually been several TV shows revolving around this. I haven't seen anything malicious, but you know very well that that this is malicious. People are deliberately hacking into cars with newer technology, and they have on TV proven that they can take over control of your car depending on the system installed on it.
Right.
I would assume the one in Teslas are pretty well advanced. You could probably – so I don't know.
Talking about,
yeah, it could have been a multiple, you know, multiple causes ganging up on him too.
Right, right, exactly.
But as far as the GPS running in the background, I actually heard when I was doing research for our next episode, when I was talking to police officers, they said that that system running in the background helps them recover stolen cars.
Oh yeah.
If someone steals your car, you just give them the VIN number, and they just, oh, there he is. Yeah. There's where he is.
Like a LoJack, so different.
Yeah. Right.
We're going to wrap things up with the answer to today's trivia question. The question was, what tailgate accessory did the first and second generation Honda CR-Vs come equipped with? Was it a porta potty, a tailgate grill, a beverage cooler, or a picnic table?
Beverage cooler. There's my guess.
Yeah, I'm thinking the cooler too.
We got two beverage coolers.
I so want to say the porta potty.
I don't think Honda would get away with that on their showroom floors. Excuse me, sir. Would you like the bathroom?
Actually,
it's right here.
That would appeal to people with children.
I was going to say, put that on the Odyssey and it would sell.
There you go.
There you go. Exactly.
You're right.
Is that part of the test drive?
I mean, they already come with a built-in vacuum cleaner. Right. So, you know.
I'm leaning towards the beverage cooler, but I have seen some odd features on some odd cars before. There's a dune buggy coming to mind.
All right. So the answer
is the grill.
The grill? You like the tailgate grill. Okay. The answer is the first and second generations of Honda's compact SUV came with a standard flip-out picnic table.
Oh, what?
I hit everything but the picnic table.
Right. For the first generations, there was also an optional shower kit for the back, too.
Oh.
But,
shower?
A shower kit for the original Honda CR-V. It must have been something that hung off the tailgate and did your thing.
All my years wasted going to beaches where they have free showers.
Wow.
Exactly. So there's your answer. Trivia question of the day. Thank you, as always, for joining us here at the table. We are The Thing About Cars, recording in Strongbox West. Please support our efforts. We're trying to raise some money to build a mobile recording studio, believe it or not. You'll find some more details about that on our website, thethingaboutcars.com. In the meantime, we hope to see you at an upcoming car show. And let us know if there's something going on in your area that we should be attending. We'd love to come take a look at you and your car, your ride, and just chat about things. I guess that's about it. Thanks, you guys. We'll talk to you soon. Be safe out there.
Bye.
Thank you for listening. This has been The Thing About Cars. We'll see you on the road.